This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Father Joe, The Man Who Saved My Soul, by Tony Hendra, narrated by the author. This book is copyrighted 2004 by Tony Hendra. This recording is copyrighted 2004 by Recorded Books. Tony Hendra attended Cambridge University, where he performed frequently with friends and future Monty Pythons John Cleese and Graham Chapman. A key comic writer and satirist of the last three decades, Father Joe is Hendra's most heartfelt and hard-hitting book, an inspiring true story of finding faith, friendship, and family through the decades-long influence of a surpassingly wise Benedictine monk named Father Joseph Warrilow. And now, Father Joe.
Prologue. There he stands, on the muddy clay of the little promontory, hands under scapula for warmth in the chill, his wide rubbery mouth beaming serenely at the grey turmoil of the English Channel. Hooked over vast ears, framing a fleshy groundhog nose and battered granny glasses, is his black monk's cowl, ancient and rudimentary shield against the blustery rain. Farther down, irredeemably flat feet, in black socks and big floppy sandals, these emerging from scruffy black robes, whipped by the squalls, and revealing, if you're lucky, glimpses of white English knees, so knobbly they could win prizes. Dom Joseph Warrilow is his formal monastic name, but everyone calls him Father Joe. I have seen him in this pose and place countless times down the years, in the flesh or in my mind's eye. Never once have I been able to stop a smile from coming to my lips. He's as close to a cartoon monk as you could imagine. And he is a saint. That poor, weary, once powerful word, bowed and enfeebled by abuse, is not used lightly. Saint does not mean merely dedication, or selflessness, or generosity, though it subsumes all those. Nor does it mean the apogee of religious devotion, though it can subsume that too, sometimes. There are many pious people who believe themselves to be saints who are not, and many people who believe themselves to be impious who are. A saint is a person who practices the keystone human virtue of humility. Humility in the face of wealth and plenty, humility in the face of hatred and violence, humility in the face of strength, humility in the face of your own genius, or lack of it, humility in the face of another's humility, humility in the face of love and beauty, humility in the face of pain and death. Saints are driven to humbling themselves before all the splendor and horror of the world, because they perceive there to be something divine in it, something pulsing and alive beneath the hard, dead surface of material things, something inconceivably greater and purer than they. This man is one of those rare, rare creatures. Gentleness and goodness come off him like aftershave. For all his irrepressible curiosity and concern, for all his love of talking and listening, and then talking some more, a great stillness surrounds him, in which he will fold you without your knowing it, numbing the pain of your most jagged obsessions, soothing away the mad priorities of your world with the balm of his peace. For more than 40 years, since I was not much more than a boy, this lumpy gargoyle of a man has been my still center, the rock of my soul, as steady and firm as the huge oak on the curve of the hill where the monastery stands, the hill that runs down to the sea. I have lost and found him more than once, gone far, far astray from the haven of his presence, but never ceased, however dimly and distantly, to love and revere him, and hunger for his company. His was the wisdom I craved, though it was never what I expected. His judgment alone I feared, though never once did he pass judgment on me. All my conscious life, he was my strongest ally, the cherished gatekeeper of my lost Eden, a lighthouse of faith blinking away through the oceanic fogs of success and money and celebrity and possessions. My intrepid guide in the tangled rainforest of human love. My silken lifeline to the divine. My Father Joe. Years ago, the promontory of clay where he stands was much farther out, but the wave's erosion is relentless. He's gazing at the gulls, swooping and diving for their lunch. He turns to me and smiles that fond, crooked smile.
Tony, dear, I was just thinking of you. How are your beautiful children?
More beautiful than ever. Happily, as they grow older, they bear less and less resemblance to their father.
And you, dear?
Still alone, Father Joe.
You are not alone, dear. We are never alone.
I remember. And every time you said that, I felt God's presence. But I felt it in you, through you. Now, I am a void. He smiles again, the old no smile, a no which has always meant yes. Taking it as an invitation, I move a little closer, hoping, just this once. But he melts away, still smiling, into the eternal rain. The bare ruined trees drip their drizzle, chill my aging body. The tide snaps and tugs at the reluctant clay. How to make my dear good friend live again? Roll back the rock from the tomb, take him by the hand, and lead him out into the light. See him laugh and teach and heal once more. Part 1. Chapter 1. How I Met Father Joe. I was 14 and having an affair with a married woman. At least, she called it an affair. She also said we were lovers, and on several occasions, doomed lovers. An average teen, I was quite content with these exalted terms. In practice, however, I only got to second base with her. I didn't yet know it was second base, as I was growing up in England. It was only rather later, too, when I saw The Graduate, that I realized my Mrs. Robinson may have been somewhat older than she admitted to, which was 22. To my unpracticed eye, she could certainly pass for that. I was still young enough that any woman with breasts and a waist and her own teeth was roughly the same age as any other, which is to say, a grown-up, and the mysterious repository of unimaginable pleasures deserving hideous, very specific torments. The fly in the ointment of this relationship was that we were both Catholics. At least in theory to me, practice to her, there was a terrible bill being racked up somewhere, calibrating the relative sinfulness of everything we did, every gesture made, every word exchanged, let alone every kiss. Should death strike, should lightning fork from one of the huge trees outside into our concupiscent bodies, should one of the experimental jets being developed over the hill at de Havilland's disintegrate and plummet to earth, as they often threatened to do when trying to break the sound barrier, turning her trailer into a fireball, down, down we would plunge into the bowels of hell, unshriven, unforgiven, damned for all eternity to indescribable suffering. A lot of what little conversation we had, much more the norm, were interminable, agonized, what she called existential silences, concerned whether we should even be having a conversation, should even be together, for that matter, doomed lovers in the throes of a hopeless and illicit liaison, wrestling with the irresistible temptation of being in the same neighborhood, town, county, country, planet, dimension. "We were so bad for one another," she said. "Such a monumental occasion of sin for each other. It was playing with fire. Oh, if only we'd never met and plunged ourselves into this cauldron of raging emotions from which there was no escape." These sentiments were very new to me. My instinctive response was that they were pretty goofy. But what did I know? I dimly recognized that I was going through some kind of passage out of childhood, and would from now on be required to learn, without being taught, how grown-ups acted and spoke. Best not to rock the boat by suppressing a classroom splutter. I had a good thing going. Mrs. Bootle was no slouch in the looks department. Perhaps this was the way women always spoke, in extremis. Books were my only guide, and so far it all seemed pretty true to form. Like being in The Thornbirds, if it had been written by Christina Rossetti. But it had been a long time since the first hesitant kiss, and we'd done lots of kissing since. I was getting restless, anxious to find out what would be the next cauldron of raging emotions from which there was no escape. Now, on a bleak Saturday morning, in the damp, dank early spring of green, green Hertfordshire, England, the world, the solar system, the universe, in the year of our Lord, 1956, I was about to find out. She stood at the kitchen end of the trailer, where the sink was, surrounded by dirty dishes, her back to the picture window, through which a waterlogged plot ran down to the river, swollen and sullen in the rain. The depressed little green caps of her higgledy-piggledy vegetable garden poking through the mud. "Should we?" she said in an agonized half-sob. "I think we should," I replied, having no idea what she was talking about. But... She never used just one but, always at least two. "It will be the end, the point of no return, all will be lost." "Well then," said the voice of proto-adult reason, "perhaps we shouldn't."
"No, no, yes, yes, how can we help ourselves? I'm swept away, I tell you. Let's cast all caution to the winds. Turn round."
I did as I was bid, averting my head and closing my eyes, mad excitement welling up through my body from my heels to my eyelids. This must be it, whatever it was. From behind me came surreptitious noises, rustling clothes, eyelets popping, zippers unzipping, hot little pants of effort.
"Turn round," she whispered hoarsely.
I did.
"Open your eyes."
I did. Her eyes were now closed, her head inclined to one side, long hair draped over her white, slight, naked shoulders, framed by the rain-drenched window, the Madonna of the drizzle. My eyes ratcheted nervously down to her breasts. They were quite small, of slightly different sizes, and rather flat. Well, actually, very flat, making the nipples seem somewhat larger than I would have expected. The baby, to all appearances a sweet little scrap, must have been a voracious feeder. These were my first live breasts. The only ones I'd seen to date had been in nudist magazines. Were they all like this? I'd just read The Four Quartets for the first time. The image of Tiresias popped into my head and wouldn't budge. Then she kissed me. Her lips and face were hotter than usual, like my little brother's when he had a temperature. She came closer. I could feel the warmth of her skin through my shirt. And then, what must have been those nipples. I put my hand inside her rolled-down dress, between her hip and her belly. "No, no," she whispered, covering my hand with hers. But she pushed it down infinitesimally. As I followed her pressure, she resisted, pulling it up even more infinitesimally. "You mustn't," she sobbed. "Think of the sin, the mortal sin, the eternal flames." Then the downward pressure again. A textbook case of no but yes, though I was too young to grasp such psychosexual antics. I followed her hand down for a few millimeters. It resisted. Up we went. But not so far. We were definitely making headway. Down, up, down, up, down. My whole hand was inside her dress now, inching inexorably earthward. Her skin was silky and her flesh deliciously soft. And it kept getting softer. Where were we? Way down there, surely. Waves of some unknown emotion shuddered through me. I was dizzy with excitement, Tiresias having definitely taken a powder. Ben and Lily Bootle had first appeared at the local Catholic church a year earlier. She was petite and slender. He was big and rangy, a head or more taller than his mate. Though she was very pregnant, she wore a clingy, full-length, shift-like dress, emphasizing her milky breasts and bulging belly. Open leather sandals advertised tiny, shapely feet. Her outfit had a distinct bohemian flair. In a Sunday congregation made up for the most part of dowdy English widows and hungover Irish labourers, with the occasional large, unruly family and cigarette-ashen wife. Ben looked as though he'd just emerged from a night of electroshock. His thick, wiry hair stood up in uncombed clumps and spikes. His clothes were always rumpled, with at least one element undone, and he wore battered tortoiseshell-rimmed glasses of impressive thickness. They seemed to have no friends, and kept very much to themselves. No one even knew where they lived, least of all our ancient and embottled parish priest, Father B. Leary. The B, for Bartholomew, leading us altar boys to call him Father Bleary. In due course, a baby Bootle appeared, which Lily carried in a rather self-consciously peasanty manner on her hip. Its gender was unclear, since it wore no conventional baby garments, being wrapped, regardless of season, in what my mother acidly called swaddling clothes. But still, no one had found out a whole lot about them, except that Ben was some kind of scientist, doing hush-hush work on jets or rockets or something. Since the church was the only place they made contact with us earthlings, it had also been noted that Ben was quite devout. As well as Sunday Mass, he would appear at non-obligatory services like rosary evenings to pray for the godless Soviets. Though our paths hadn't crossed, serving Mass was also one of my chores, which I loathed, not only because of the tongue-twisting Latin responses, but also because Father Bleary had last brushed his teeth to celebrate victory over the Kaiser, and his breath would have stopped even the leper-hugging St. Francis dead in his tracks. One moment of the Mass in particular, the lavabo, at which the server is required to ritually wash the priest's fingers, putting the anointed face inches from yours, was like being gassed in the trenches at Verdun. My level of devotion was at a fairly obligatory level. I was the product of what the church called a mixed marriage, one between a Catholic and a non-Catholic, which in my father's case meant nothing fun like a Muslim or a Satanist, but simply a desultory agnostic, a non-believer in anything much, really. Ironically, he was a stained-glass artist, so he spent far more time inside churches and knew far more about Catholic iconography than his nominally Catholic brood. My mother was what the priests called a good Catholic. She attended Mass every Sunday and holiday of obligation, went to confession once a month, shelled out handfuls of silver when required, but otherwise, as far as I could tell, didn't allow the precepts of the Gospels and their chief spokesman to interfere much with her daily round of gossip, bitching, kid-slapping, neighbor-bashing, petty vengeance, and other middle-class peccadilloes. One aspect of my mother's behavior did seem to me to be well up the scale of venial sin, if not all the way to mortal. She shared with local non-Catholics a broad prejudice against the Irish laborers who were appearing in our village in considerable numbers, as they were in many other parts of England, to work in the ongoing reconstruction of post-war Britain, particularly the new motorways, all of whom were Catholic. The vast majority of these workers were fleeing chronic unemployment in the new republic and brought with them habits of poverty that didn't sit well with the upwardly mobile Protestant burghers of southeast England. The drinking and plangent midnight singing in the street, naturally, but also the taking a leak round any old corner, the possession of only one jacket and pair of trousers, worn to the construction site every morning, to the pub every night, to church on Sunday, and to sleep in any time. Mostly, they were loathed just for being Irish. The depth of British odium for a people they robbed, murdered, enslaved and starved for 800 years is hard to exaggerate. I often experienced it at second hand when gangs of local toughs would run me to cover as I walked home from school, screaming, "Dirty Catholic, go home!" and heaving stones at me. True, British anti-Catholic prejudice harked back to the 17th century, and was institutionalized in many ways. But it's unlikely these troglodytes had the excesses of James II on their tiny minds. For them, Catholic and Irish were interchangeable slurs. I hadn't made this connection yet. Kids tend to take prejudice in their stride, a fixed peril you find a route around on your journey toward adulthood. For the moment, its larger meaning was opaque, and my dealings with it open to compromise, if not outright collaboration. Example. Every November 5th in England, Guy Fawkes, a Catholic conspirator of the early 17th century, who almost succeeded in blowing up the Houses of Parliament, is burned in effigy on thousands of bonfires across the land. While it's fine that Guy Fawkes be remembered for what he was, an odious anti-democratic terrorist, this custom has for centuries also expressed and refueled anti-Catholic prejudice. So every Sunday before Guy Fawkes Day, Catholic priests would condemn it and order Catholics not to participate. For me, a serial pyromaniac, the prospect of no bonfire was bad enough. But it also meant missing the truly glorious part of Guy Fawkes Day, fireworks. In a mixed marriage, this sort of thing could be sheer poison. The arrangement my father worked out was as follows. A. Fireworks. Naturally. Kids have to have fireworks. B. Smallish bonfire. Though I'd always creep out in the night and pile it higher, and if possible stick tires in it. C. Absolutely no Guy, as the effigy of Mr. Fawkes is known. When my mother objected that we were still symbolically burning a Catholic, Dad would reply yes, but every time we let off a firework, we were symbolically blowing up the Houses of Parliament. So then we'd celebrate the same prejudice that got rocks thrown at my head on the way home from school, and the same prejudice that had the good villagers muttering about lazy drunks and refusing to rent rooms to the Irish, or serve them in their shops. I found this obnoxious in them, and, to the degree that she agreed, in my mother. I'd like to pretend that I was smart enough at 14 to have worked all this out in total consistency. But in fact, I had simply picked up from somewhere an aversion to discriminating against people because they had next to nothing and did work no one else wanted to do. Unbeknownst to me, there was more at work than mere altruism. A deeper bond made me take the Irish side. If challenged, Mum would have said she was just being protective in putting as much distance as possible between us kids and the boyos down the pub. She certainly did in church, where she would sit as far away as she could from her boozy co-religionists, moving up a row or two if they got too close. Something much juicier, however, was going on beneath these maternal protestations. She always insisted that her maiden name, McGovern, was Scottish, even though it began with M.C., as all the finest Irish names do, not M.A.C., like all the finest Scottish ones. She and the other four McGovern sisters had indeed been born in Glasgow, so she did have that on her side. But as one of her older sisters would say, less skittish than she about their true origins, if a cat has kittens in the oven, are they biscuits? Nonetheless, Mum stuck to her guns. We were Scottish and proud of it. Ach, awa the new. Of course, the British weren't much fonder of the Scots than they were of the Irish. But on the spectrum of Anglo-Saxon anti-Celtic prejudice, she evidently felt it was better to be ridiculed as Scottish than despised as Irish. Once, when I was about 10, Dad brought home a book of Scottish tartans. He was painstaking about the heraldic and chivalric symbols he used in his windows, and I got very excited over the rich old aristocratic patterns. Surely, with our deep Scottish roots, we must have a tartan. That, in turn, would mean we could wear a kilt. Ach, awa the new. This line of questioning threw Mum for the biggest loop so far. That one, she said, pointing at the Campbell tartan. But that's the Campbell tartan, I objected. Well, she fired back, the McGoverns are part of the Campbell clan. Only later, when I moved to New York, where I met dozens of McGoverns, every one as Irish as a pint of stout, did all become clear. I realized that the closest my maternal ancestors had ever come to the Highlands and a Campbell kilt was the wilds of County Leitrim. If I'd known at the time how Irish I was, I mightn't have been so pleased about it. I wasn't a whole lot keener about being a Catholic. This had less to do with being on the receiving end of prejudice than with the growing gap between what I heard in church and learned in school. Not that my mother hadn't tried to prevent the gap from growing. The mixed marriage contract, the church required the infidel half of the couple to sign, said that all resulting offspring had to be brought up in the faith. If humanly possible, this meant being sent to a Catholic school. Between the ages of 5 and 8, therefore, I had gone to the nuns, in this case Dominicans, followers of the intrepid Spanish preacher Domingo de Guzman, a.k.a. St. Dominic, scourge of the Cathars, and inventor of the very first version of the Inquisition. The good sisters were known by baffling names, like Sister Mary Joseph, Sister Mary Frederick, and Sister Mary Martin. While they never actually condemned us first graders to an auto da fe, they certainly devised some Inquisition-level torments to instill the one true faith in us. And to be fair, they were effective. Why did God make you? God made me to know him, love him, and serve him in this world, and to be happy with him forever in the next. There are several concepts and assumptions in this catechesis which might be a little beyond a 6-year-old, but half a century later I can still recite it in my sleep. The next stop, after the good sisters, was the good brothers. These hard men ran a joint called, benignly enough, St. Columba's, quartered in a sprawling old Victorian mansion. I've blanked on the name of their order. I'd like to think it included some phrase like St. Aloysius the Impaler. but it was probably more along the lines of the Holy Brothers of the Little Flower. They were, to a man, Irish. In all my years in and out of the church, I've never come across a gang so utterly unholy. They dressed in lay clothes and wore lay haircuts, and as far as anyone could tell, they performed no religious observances whatsoever. Nothing distinguished them from what they appeared to be, members of a sleeper cell of the IRA, or participants in some particularly vicious form of organized crime. They beat us with their belts, they beat us with their metal rulers. The thin side, not the flat. They set dogs on boys who strayed into their quarters. They had beer on their breath at morning assembly. They encouraged the older boys, especially if they had Irish surnames, to beat the crap out of the smaller ones ad majorem Dei Gloriam. This toughening up process would turn us 7- and 8-year-old boys into good soldiers of Christ. Religion was invoked only as a prelude to violence. The fires of hell awaited any infraction or indiscipline, especially the mortal sin of being anywhere near a holy brother with a mourning head. Threatening the fear of damnation had limited force. As far as I could tell, I was already in hell. Disputes between boys were settled on the spot by boxing bouts, not with padded sparring gloves either, but 10-ounce ring gloves. The first time this happened to me, I tearfully objected that I didn't know how to box, and couldn't I run a race or something? Whereupon Brother Colm, who happened to be headmaster, snarled, "You'll settle it with the gloves, as Christ intended." I scrolled mentally through the Gospels, for occasions where Jesus had gone a couple of rounds with the Pharisees or Sadducees. Nothing. Then the other boy hit me in the face and knocked me out. After I came home for the umpteenth time, with a bloody nose, or my arse covered in welts, or a smashed hand bandaged in a handkerchief, there being no school nurse at St. Columba's, the soldiers of Christ performed their own first aid, my parents decided that the mixed marriage contract notwithstanding, my Catholic education was at an end. My first Protestant stop was a small Church of England prep school with pretensions to be rather classier than was merited by its location, a nouveau riche dormitory town north of London. I didn't like it much, and perhaps as payback to some greater educational authority in the sky, I became possessed by a demon of petty crime, a juvenile delinquent playing right into the stereotype of the perfidious Irish Catholic. Excluded from morning prayers each day and C of E religious instruction several times a week, I spent the time allocated for spiritual reflection rifling through the pockets of my classmates' coats and jackets in the cloakroom. I could garner vast sums this way, sometimes as much as 10 or 15 shillings a day, a huge sum for a preteen in the mid-50s. The proceeds were then spent at the local Gaumont cinema. My visits were so regular that Mum became convinced that it really did take 3.5 hours to get home on the bus, not the official hour or so. I caught, at least 4 or 5 times each, the Ealing comedies, Olivier's Henry V, Billy Wilder's Sunset Boulevard, and a long succession of early Technicolor Hollywood goodies. Best of all, the garish biblical epics that aging 1930s moguls were pumping out to nip TV in the bud, and in some cases to subliminally bolster the scriptural claims of the new state of Israel. My all-time favorite was Samson and Delilah, with ravishing Yvonne de Carlo as the hair-clipping houri and bulging Victor Mature as Samson. It riveted me that Samson's breasts were almost as big as Delilah's. One of my earliest sexual crises had been rage and bafflement that I would never be able to have a baby, and I found Mr. Mature's bosoms strangely comforting. I became adept at theft, staggering my raids and leaving the heavier copper and bronze coins in the victims' pockets, so that they wouldn't discover their loss till they were out of school, where it could be blamed on their own carelessness. I'm sure the authorities were leaning over backward to be Christ-like and tolerant, hesitant to conclude that the school's only Catholic was ripping off his Protestant classmates. Eventually, the well-meaning dolts put a patrol on the cloakroom, but by then the demon had parted as abruptly as it came, leaving me with no further taste for felony. I'd scored high in the 11-plus exams and won a place at the best school in the county. Then, to everyone's surprise, including my own, I won several events at the end-of-term athletics meet and was declared my year's champion. A top student and a track star could hardly be a thief. So the good profs not only provided me with a small fortune in stolen goods and a solid grounding in Hollywood movies, they sent me on my way with a silver cup. Robbery, violence, Hollywood. All classic enemies of Catholic piety. By the time I arrived at St. Albans School, at the age of 11, I was already drifting away from Holy Mother Church. St. Albans was nominally C of E. It was also the oldest surviving school in England, having been founded by the Benedictine monks of St. Albans Abbey in A.D. 948. This meant, for what it was worth, that it had been Catholic far longer than it had been Church of England, from 948 to the dissolution being roughly 600 years, while the Protestants had had it only since then, a paltry 400. Up until the Second World War, it had been a minor public school, but by the time I got there, the socialist levelling that was transforming British education had swept most of this religious and classist history away. St. Albans was a government-funded feeder school for the coming meritocracy, and academic excellence was its overwhelming concern. The level was scary. Where, up to this point, I'd had little trouble making it to the top rank of any class, here I was just one of the anonymous, striving middle. The aim became simply to keep your head down and your marks up. The syllabus included Latin and Greek, but there was no doubt about the long-term utilitarian emphasis, math and science, with English and French literature a distant third. Our classes were seated in alphabetical order, and right in front of me for my first 3 years was an inarticulate homunculus named Stephen Hawking. The great utility of Hawking to his classmates was that he could do math and physics homework at the speed of light. A concept, by the way, only he seemed able to grasp. He usually had the homework finished by the end of lunch hour, and the thuggier element in his class, including me, found it easy to persuade him to share it. Our math and physics marks were terrific, until the inevitable day of a test, which Hawking would finish in minutes, and sit, snuffling and grinning and doodling for the remainder of the hour, while the rest of us sweated through the now incomprehensible scientific runes. The custom of using Hawking as a source for spiffy homework marks persisted until sometime in the third year, when he began moving at warp speed. Now he would take a fairly simple problem of, say, calculus, as the pretext for a far-ranging dissertation, expressing itself in pages and pages of equations and formulae that no doubt stopped just short of the event horizon. The Claudia types duly copied all this out, figuring it would lead to massive bonus marks. It didn't, and soon Hawking disappeared from all math classes to pursue his destiny alone. The fine print in the church's mixed marriage contract demanded that where offspring were forced to attend a non-Catholic school, religious instruction should counteract the heathen lies with which their little ears were filled. In practice, my syllabus was so arduous that I had no time for religious instruction, even if it had been available in a small country village. So there was no counterweight to my favoured subjects history, and organic chemistry, leading my education in an increasingly secular direction. History textbooks hadn't caught up with post-war historical thought or research. They tended to be Anglo-centric, casually anti-Catholic, and often virulently anti-papal. This was very much the case in my favorite period, the Middle Ages. One of the more egregious examples of skewed papal history concerned a local lad, Nicholas Breakspear, who in the mid-12th century rose from being abbot of St. Albans to become Adrian IV, the only Englishman ever to attain the papacy. Breakspear, it was emphasized, was that very rare bird, a good pope. A teenager eagerly and uncritically lapping up all such great stuff, I had no frame of reference to judge it by. As the curial bureaucrats who wrote the mixed marriage contract no doubt foresaw, I much preferred the new analysis to the old, maternal, pro-church one. My fascination with chemistry added fuel to the heretical pyre. The clear message of chemistry, especially of lab experiments, which I had never done before, was that everything in the phenomenological world had an explanation, and that if it couldn't yet be explained, further research would soon do the job. It didn't take a genius to figure out that the standard proof of God's existence, someone must have made it all, began to get a little rocky in the lab. There was the evidence in the microscope slide. Amoebas reproduced all by themselves, without a flash of lightning or a big finger pointing at them, just as they had long ago, in kicking off the chain of evolution that led to Hawking. For me, there was another factor, too, in some ways more all-encompassing, and from a strict doctrinal point of view, more insidious. I had fallen in love with the Hertfordshire countryside. Hertfordshire contains many of the signature images of the great landscape artist John Constable. Slow, meandering streams winding through lush meadows, intersected with vast stands of elm. Gentle hills and soft, bosomy fields, trimmed with neatly laid hedges of hawthorn and hazel. Animals of all kinds, wild and domestic, in huge profusion. Rich clay and loam, its vegetation moist and bulbous, bursting with primal juice. You could hardly break a stalk in the meadows without some thick or milky essence bleeding from the plant. I don't mean I passed my youth in a Wordsworthian trance. I had goals. The most important was the killing of small waterfowl and the roasting of them over an open fire. Hunting, in turn, required the construction of weapons. First, spears, with, for one brief and frustrating period, hand-chipped flint tips, but later, and more practically, bows and arrows. In the wonder years that I spent wandering the countryside with my lethal weapons, I never managed to kill a single living thing, let alone roast it, though I did once find an arrow sticking in the rump of our neighbouring farmer's Guernsey. She didn't seem to mind. He was livid. I was fixated on a tubby little waterfowl called a moorhen. Ducks were iffy, since they might belong to someone. But when moorhens broke cover, they ran in crazy, evasive patterns, and you couldn't get a bead on them. But failure didn't matter. My self-image as an intrepid hunter, alone in the wilderness, surviving on my wits, implacably tracking my prey, was reward enough. I built a succession of secret huts from interwoven reeds and boughs and grass. I got quite good at sighting these in natural blinds and clumps of vegetation to minimize construction, which made them even more secret. Nothing better than to sit in the mouth of a secret reed hut after a hard morning's hunt, a campfire sizzling in the drizzle, toasting a slice of bread or a sausage, and puffing on a dried, rolled-up dock leaf. Tomorrow, always assuming I could figure out how to pluck it and gut it. A fat moorhen would be spitted over this very fire, and my entire life would be fulfilled. Nobody knew where I was. Nobody could find me. I was one with my allies, the trees and leaves and folds in the earth, the banks and hedges and stands of wild grass. On fine days, the sunlight became a co-conspirator, filtering through the filigree of leaves and vegetation to make a second, even more secure dimension of dappled camouflage, and me even more invisible. This was when I first came across Marvell's annihilating all that's made to a green thought in a green shade. No doubt I was creating an alternate or fantasy life, food, shelter, security, in rejection of the ones my parents provided. But nothing so tediously psychological ever occurred to me. I was happy without knowing it, at peace, long before I knew how crucial and elusive peace is. One summer, a terrible epidemic called myxomatosis ran through the entire wild rabbit population. And there were little corpses of my former prey everywhere, their eyeballs forced halfway out of their skulls by the jelly-like tumors the disease causes, making their eyes, still staring wildly in death, look like tumors themselves. There were trophies everywhere, meat for the taking, but I could only think, what a horrible way to die, for my friends and co-conspirators to die. And that in some implacable way, my callousness had caused their agony. Why was this all a doctrinal threat? Because my woods and meadows seemed a much better church than the church. The irresistible force of life, the tiny eggs appearing in the nest, the buds on the dead wood of winter, evidenced a much more immediate presence of something divine than the presence that was supposed to exist in the tabernacle on the altar. There, beneath a flickering red lamp that was always lit to indicate he was home, the Saviour is in. Was Christ himself really present in the Holy Eucharist, a chalice full of consecrated wafers? We were taught this was a sacramental presence, the outward sign of inward grace. The standard exegesis was that while the outward accidents of the bread did not change at the moment of consecration, its essence, that which made it bread and bread alone, had been transformed into the essence of Jesus Christ, that which made him, and him alone, the Son of God. A neat analysis, and if true, a mind-boggling miracle. The trouble was, I felt nothing, gazing up at Christ's little brass hut. No presence at all, just the exotic odor of last Sunday's incense, and that dusty, mushroomy smell of decay all churches have, whatever their age. Whereas, under my canopy of sun-dappled leaves, I certainly felt the presence of something, and something I was quite prepared to say was divine, powerful, benign, even loving, and if beyond my ken, not that far beyond. It could be God, or a god, or more likely, a goddess, the spirit of sun-dappled leaves. The lazy River Lee, polluted though it was still a miracle, a whole liquid universe of life. One early summer evening, down along the River Lee, following my best moorhen route, I came upon something I'd never noticed before, concealed by thick curtains of willow fronds and giant reeds. A decrepit trailer, with saggy old power lines running into the trees, painted a morose green. In the yard outside, a couple, one with a baby on her hip, were tending a newly turned garden. I'd come upon the secret lair of Mr. and Mrs. Mystery, Ben and Lily Bootle. Contrary to my standard reaction on sighting other humans, to become a green thought in a green shade, I decided I'd initiate a meeting. I don't know why, Perhaps I thought that these oddballs skulking in the rushes were kindred spirits. The first few minutes were awkward. Three woodland creatures, toting the customary baggage of English social inhibitions, nosing around each other, testing out the possibilities of contact. It was like an early draft of The Wind in the Willows, before Graham decided to focus on rodents. Evidently, they felt some level of comfort. After the usual stammered apologies and overlapping courtesies, we all ended up in the trailer. Inside was chaos incarnate. At one end, there was a sleeping area entirely filled with an unmade double bed and a baby's cot draped with diapers, possibly clean. At the other end was a narrow kitchen, piled with dishes and used food. In between was an unkempt living area stuffed with books, littered with discarded clothing, and dominated by a handsome old upright piano, a Bechstein. Ben was an odd bird. He wore Coke bottle glasses, askew his large, pointy nose, which had a little ball of flesh on the end, as if to protect you from the point. He always seemed to be looking over your head, or through you, to some far horizon. Together with his stuttery, upper-crust accent, this gave him an arrogant air, mitigated somewhat by a wildly disorganized exterior. Lily was timid and retiring. She had little to offer in the way of information or opinion that wasn't simply echoing the Lord and Master. Ben stuttered that a cup of tea might be nice, and she hurried busily back into the kitchen area, but then did nothing, and the tea never materialized. The rather stilted conversation turned to where I went to school. St. Albans, I said. Ben looked shocked. Naturally, so did Lily. But that's a Protestant school, stammered he. I explained about the local lack of acceptable Catholic secondary education. He became quite agitated, his glasses glinting with concern at the peril in the distance. Is anyone giving you religious instruction? I said, no. But that's terrible. He was now blinking fast and twitching. I was only 14 and on uncertain ground. I agreed it was terrible, but it was a fantastic school, and that's irrelevant, snapped Ben. Lily agreed mutely in the background. It's a question of your immortal soul. A bit much, only 5 minutes into our first meeting. These were words I'd only ever heard in an Irish brogue. Ben was now staring intensely at someone far, far away over my left shoulder. I have an idea, he said. I'll give you instruction. I didn't know what to say. I looked at Lily to see if there was any other opinion in the room before the chairman banged the gavel. She smiled at me in a saintly way, as if to say, "Tonight a soul has been saved." That's that, then, said Ben, standing up abruptly. I'll speak to your parents tomorrow. My mother was agreeable. Ben had a Tofts accent and a Cambridge degree, and his proposal assuaged her guilt at my being in a heathen school. My dad took his normal hands-off attitude toward the whole subject. And so it began. There was a reason for Ben's uncompromising doctrinal stance. He was a recent convert, with the recent convert's bright-eyed enthusiasm for all things Catholic. After meeting Lily and a speedy courtship, he'd proposed. She, being a practicing Catholic, the marriage would have to be the good old mongrel kind. According to the fine print, Ben, just like my father, had been required to take a test drive through the big doctrines. Unlike my father, he had been blown away by the logical beauty of it all. His conversion was no born-again rush of emotion. Ben would claim, with a glint of weird humour in his glasses, that he had no emotions, Lily nodding with rather more warmth than usual. Ben took pride in being cold, detached, objective, logical. This was not altogether a pose. He had a first in mathematics from Cambridge, at a time when the university had an unparalleled reputation for physicists and mathematicians, Bertrand Russell, Fred Hoyle, et al. The parish scuttlebutt that he worked on something hush-hush like nuclear research wasn't totally inaccurate. He had taken a high-level defense job when he came down from Cambridge, which probably got him out of his 2 years national service. He didn't talk about it much, except to say he didn't like the work and was hoping to become a teacher. His oddest self-description was that he was intrinsically Teutonic. The gleam in his glasses would get even weirder on this tack. He had a Teutonic temperament. His lack of emotion was Teutonic. His coldness and logic were Teutonic. Teutonic discipline was his model. In 50s Britain, with the flowers still fresh on the war graves and bombed-out cities still waiting to be rebuilt, all thanks to a certain gang of Teutons, this was cheeky stuff. It might indeed have begun as some undergraduate épater les bourgeois pose. However it had started, wherever it had come from, the Teutonic thing suffused his self-image. And it was at the core of his relationship with his wife, the only thing that brought Lily to life. She, according to Ben's analysis, was the diametric opposite of his Teutonic temperament, being French by birth, though raised in England, and therefore consumed at all times by uncontrollable emotions. She was happy to embrace this stereotype. It gave them something they could agree upon, a template on which their marriage could function. A Teutonic temperament and a French temperament, living in uneasy harmony across an emotional Maginot line. Cold blood versus hot, logic versus impulse, head versus heart, mind versus matter, stoic versus swept away, Alsace-Lorraine versus the Saarland. It was rich. It explained everything. It even got a laugh once in a while. "That's so Teutonic, dear," she would murmur, when he mowed the reeds outside in straight rows. Except, how else would he do it? Meanwhile, she'd agree that getting depressed about housework and thus not doing it was typically French and over-emotional. Except that French wives are house-proud to the point of psychosis. As my visits grew more regular, I joined in the fun, an easy way to ingratiate myself. There was an awkward moment when I first crashed the party, as if they weren't sure they wanted someone else in the game. I tried to diffuse some tense domestic moment with a crack about the Franco-Prussian War. But once I was in, I was part of the family. It was the exact opposite of three's a crowd. A third person gave new energy and validity to the template. Throughout that summer and the autumn, I spent more and more time in and around the decrepit green trailer. There was something appealing about its invisibility, that neither my parents, nor my siblings, nor the only village subgroup I belonged to, the Catholic parishioners, knew where I was. The trailer was the latest version of my secret hut, a new green shade for new green thoughts. There was plenty to think about. Ben was a ferocious docent. I'd just turned 14, but he taught at his level and what he could grasp, not at mine and what I could. On the positive indoctrination side, our team, I got mostly his beloved Aquinas, the proofs of the existence of God and exegesis of the mysteries, for example, the Trinity, the Eucharist, with some Cardinal Newman for ballast. On the negative reinforcement, and much more rigorous side, their team, was a shooting war on error. The reasons why every Western philosopher, from the Reformation on, had got it all wrong. He blew up the errorists from Bishop Berkeley to Bertrand Russell. Much of the error was over my head, but what did stick I found rather more interesting than Ben's refutations. My carapace of faith in Catholicism was flimsier than I'd realized. Philosophy, not taught in my school or most English schools, was new and engrossing. So whenever I found something inconsistent in Ben's argument against the enemy, I balked and argued the point as best I could. Lily was fascinated with these exchanges, which I never got the best of. She'd sit at the table after dinner, or out on the trailer steps on a summery evening, and nod and smile at my points. I was naive enough to think this was because she actually agreed with them, instead of my being the surrogate for something she didn't have the nerve to do, talk back to Ben. One evening, I got hopelessly entangled in some contentious point having to do with faith and reason, and didn't the distinction between them have to be taken on faith? I hadn't the foggiest idea where I was going with my argument, and Ben was demolishing it anyway. I became quite tongue-tied and pissed off. Let me finish. Leave me alone. You're wrong. Wait. Ben came out of the objective, detached, Teutonic trance in which he taught, and actually looked me straight in the eye. "No need to be so prickly," he said. Lily laughed, for the first time I could remember. "That's it," she cried at me. "You're a hedgehog. When things get too much, you roll up in a prickly ball and hide from the world. From now on," she said, "I'm going to call you Hedgehog." She gave me a dazzling smile. Another first. Ben just looked bemused at this flood of Gallic feeling. So now I was Hedgehog. Our Hedgehog. My Hedgehog. Silly old Hedgehog. Hedgy. Hoggy. A typical teen with the self-confidence of your average mollusk, I was delighted that I had enough identity to warrant a nickname. There was a lot of work to do in the trailer and garden that autumn, and I volunteered to help out in my spare time. Because Ben was now looking for teaching work, he was often away for whole evenings, and for the first time I was with Lily alone. She was jollier than when Ben was around, and treated me as an equal, which I appreciated, since she was, after all, a grown-up, a member of the parental class, my tribal superior. One sunny autumn evening, I was clearing some rotten lumber from the reeds when I began to feel I was being watched. It made me self-conscious, and it puzzled me. I'd never seen another soul down there. I kept going, ignoring whoever it was. It got too much. I had to look round. No one. Then I noticed Lily staring at me through the picture window of the trailer. She had her hands crossed at the wrists over her breasts. It looked bonkers to me, as if she were posing as the effigy of a medieval saint. I waved. She came out of her trance and waved back. I returned to my chore. Minutes later, the same sensation. Now Lily stood just a few yards away. The setting sun behind her shone through her brown hair.